Hi, he's Pinky and I'm the brain and this is the Unstable Fluid Podcast.
Jeez. Oh, how many of these do you have?
There's a list, I'm going to be honest. Every single time we record, I have to go through and figure out exactly what vibe we're in. I will like say that my partner helped me pick which of us was Pinky and which of us was the brain for that.
I like the supposition that you're the brain.
I've got the PhD.
Only because you started sooner.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to cling on to dear life for the next 2 years and then admit defeat that I am definitely more Pinky energy. But like, until then.
Okay, sure. I've realized something that we never do when we start these episodes. As much as we do the stupid introduction, we never actually introduce ourselves.
They don't need to know my name. They only need to know the brain.
Okay.
For this episode.
Well, I mean, given the title of this episode, fair.
Yeah. Hey, let's pretend that was intentional. Yeah.
How are you doing, Kat?
I'm doing good, thank you, Thomas. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Stressed, but that's just life at the minute. Need a holiday.
Stressed? Work stress? Or...
Yeah, mostly.
You sound so checked out, I'm going to be honest.
I've had a very busy couple of weeks. I've got paper comments that need to be dealt with that are getting dealt with this week, but I spent like all of last week at a collaboration meeting that I probably won't go into in too much detail at the minute because I think we might be doing that next time, but
that's fair enough. I mean, I shouldn't tell you this before you submit your new paper, but I have a new fear unlocked of make sure that you read the edits when you get your papers back from the journals. I am in the like correction stage approved now, it's just typesetting. Got the proof back from the journal saying, right, this is what it looks like, double check, you know, small minor typos. And they used the original version of the paper, so the one that I submitted before all my reviewer comments and edits and quite substantial changes in that final edit. So that was, I nearly just emailed them like, yeah, it looks great. And I'm like, no, make sure you proofread everything.
I've heard of like cases where editors have tried to change things in a way that like makes it more in line with the style of the journal and have just like butchered figures.
Yeah.
To the point they've been like, the authors had to go back and be like, you realize you've changed the figure entirely, right?
Yeah. There's definitely like tricks you can get around it of like, once you know you're submitting to a journal, use the style guide that they have already to try and preempt that. But yeah, make sure you read.
I do that. My mine is very much typeset in the journal that we're going to submit to.
Luckily, the editors that I'm working with on this paper are delightful and they were immediately apologetic and we're going to get it all sorted. And, you know, one day there'll be a paper out there. But yeah, that unlocked a new fear in me of if I'd said yes to that, I would have been in so much trouble with my collaborators for not reading things. Consequences of my actions so nearly caught me.
Aside from nearly like saying yes to paper revisions that you didn't mean to, how are you? What have you been up to?
I'm good. So this at point of recording, which I realize is a dangerous thing to say when outing how long it takes us between recording and publishing and all that sort of stuff, I am 1 week out of celebrating my 4-year streaming anniversary, which involved 12 hours of maths exams. Thomas, I'd sat 12 hours of maths exams.
That's what, like a GCSE, right?
Yeah, I know they do things differently up in Scotland, but like...
we don't sit anywhere near as many exams.
Yeah, I did think about including a highers, but it didn't fit. 24-hour exam and I'll include Scotland as well. The amount of chaos that was caused on stream to fundraise involved in exam papers upside down and exam papers in Welsh and 12 hours of streaming for charity, which was so much fun, but oh dear god, did I need to like tone down my work for the rest of the week around it just to kind of compensate for how mentally draining it was.
Yeah, I was only able to like pop in for like a little bit of it because that was like during my collaboration meeting, and I'm like, yeah, I think I rocked up just after you finished the Welsh paper. And yeah, you could tell it was like it was almost reaching like fever dream levels of chaos.
I don't remember most of it, which I think is what people say when you do like endurance marathons and stuff. It sort of all blends into one. But like I know I sat a paper in Welsh. I can't remember any of it.
Do you remember like the 1,300 folk raiding all at once?
Yeah, they were delightful. I mean, part of what made it so fun and enjoyable was like the audience being incredibly chaotic the entire time, which Yeah, if any of them have managed to sneak their way over to the UFP, hi, welcome. So that was nice. And then I'm so glad that we've had the bank holiday afterwards so I can have like 3 days of rest and just like turn work emails off, hide my work computer, like really, really detach.
Bank holidays been very nice. Just to decompress. Bank holidays for those outside the UK is like public holidays. It's a day off.
Yeah.
That most people get.
Not all, but yes.
Notoriously, the banks get the holidays, but like things like Tesco is still open.
Yes. Yeah. And the gym. It's honestly part of it, like an escape for me nowadays, and there's a group of us that all go together. But I found it really interesting. So we went on Monday morning, and then my plan for the rest of the day was like play video games and chill out and maybe catch up on some chores, but like not. But the group that I went with, some of them were PhD students and they went back to work. And they were in the office on the bank holiday because they wanted to catch up with some stuff or just like stay ahead of it. And it really reminded me of like during my PhD, I probably would have done exactly the same. It's only now that I'm postdoc that I really bank holidays, weekends, holidays are more like sacred to me. And I don't know what it is psychologically about like having the time off, like I'm paid for the 9 to 5, I'll work the 9 to 5. Maybe, you know, a 12-hour celebration shifts that slightly, but then, you know, I balance it a lot more than I used to, which I thought was interesting and probably good development for me.
Yeah, it's interesting. I certainly, like, know a lot of people that do that same sort of thing with their PhDs of, like, just working very much not like a 9 to 5. Mm-hmm. Personally, I don't tend to do that. Like, if I shift at all, it's shifting, like, maybe an hour or two, and I shift the whole day by, like, an hour or two.
Oh, okay.
Just depends on, like, when I get up, or if I want to go for a swim before work and don't want to get up, like, 5:30 in the morning. I don't know, maybe I'm in that sort of thing of, I've always tried to stick to the sort of 9-to-5 thing, like, even through undergrad, I tried not to do ridiculous amounts of work in the evening. Mostly because I did too many other things in the evening.
Oh, that's true, yeah. Many, many extracurriculars going on.
The other factor for me in undergrad, I'm realizing this literally right this second, is that for the first 2 years of undergrad, I had catered halls. I had breakfast, had a set time. And if you didn't show up to breakfast before 9:30, you didn't get breakfast.
Oh, that's weird. That's really interesting. Not weird, but like, I mean, weird to me. That's so fascinating.
But it meant that I didn't do the whole like wake up at like 11 a.m. I mean, I also had 9 a.m. lectures for the first 2 years, which also was a factor, but like,
yes, because we all went to our lectures all of the time because we were responsible students and definitely did that. That's interesting though, that yeah, I suppose if you're stuck within like someone else's routine or if you have something else around you that kind of helps motivate that, like I think noticing the people that were more well-adjusted had housemates that were also working the 9 to 5. So, like, there is a schedule in the house.
Yeah, I was going to say the other factor I have is that my partner works a 9 to 5. Mm. So, like, there's that as well. It doesn't let me get, like,
yeah,
6 hours out of sync like some people.
Yeah, I can't imagine they'd be particularly happy with you just like, no, I'm going to do PhD work till 3 a.m.
I wouldn't be very happy with me doing that.
Yeah, video editing maybe, but, like, not PhD.
Because the PhD sits in that sort of, I don't know, weird space between being a student and having a job. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, like some people take it and more like a job. Like I actually try to take the holiday I'm entitled to and that sort of thing.
Proud of you.
Whereas a lot of people don't.
Yes, and they should. Just putting that out there. Yeah. The official, what is it, tagline of, not your tagline, party line. The official party line of the UFP is that PhD students should take their holidays. It's good for them.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting watching different approaches. I've seen a lot of bias towards, like, if you're a morning person and you're in the office by 9 a.m, you are better, like, more well-adjusted on the PhD program, which I don't inherently agree with. Latent night owl, let me work till 3 a.m. person myself, I did all right, but there's definitely something to be said about it.
The departments that are more willing to accommodate your sort of flexible hours, people work when is best for them, I've noticed that quite a few of them do this sort of, they have a sort of core hours where they expect people to be available of like 10 till 3 or something like that.
Yeah.
So like they won't schedule big meetings for loads of people before 10 a.m. or after 3 p.m. if they can avoid it, because some people will work 10 till 6, others will do 9 to 5, others will come in earlier and do like 8 till 4 or something.
Yeah, something that I didn't realise because it didn't affect me, but when there was a big petition during my PhD, I think, to sort of readjust how the undergrad hours were allocated. So Bath have 8:15 start lectures, which is to their disgust.
That's odd.
Yeah, so it, I don't know if it was just during COVID time or if it is a thing, but they were 8:15 till 6:15 was the possible hours that you could have lectures. So I used to teach a 5 till 6 lecture on a Thursday, and it's like, whew. I had some students. I had some. But yeah, where I was going with that was there was a big readjustment, and it was sort of made apparent of like why certain lectures are shifted, and part of the sort of core hours factors in people with childcare responsibilities. So people mm-hmm. who are more likely to do the school runs, for example, will get preference over shifting their lectures and their tutoring allocations to make time for that, which I thought was very sweet because, like, yeah, I can take some late shifts if it means that someone can, like, prioritize their, you know, family a bit better. Like, it distributes nicely over us. Obviously, there are people in academia that disagreed with that, but, like, I personally thought it was awesome.
I can see people being on, like, different sides of it, like...
Mm. It's all well and good until you actually get the 8:15 lecture and you're like, ah.
8:15 is just disgustingly early. But yeah, anyway, I think we've been kind of skirting around our main topic for today, which is trying to do that sort of the thing that we all say we should do and all do to varying levels of success, which is actually trying to balance that whole life and work aspect of being a researcher, whether that's at like PhD level or postdoc or just generally balancing work and life.
Yeah. Like, as I said, I think it's something that I personally have gotten better at post-PhD, especially going into write-up, not to scare you, Thomas, but notoriously write-up is the bit where all of that stuff goes out the window. So preemptively getting a good balance or getting a good idea of what the right balance is for you now is going to help when you go forward.
Yeah, though with the standard caveats of you disappeared off to America for 3 months during your write-up and all that sort of thing as well.
Yeah, ignoring international travel and couch surfingness and job huntingness and any other minor disaster that may or may not occur during your thesis write-up. I think typically talking to other people, watching Simon's vlogs.
Oh, those are a fever dream in themselves.
Yeah. Notoriously, I've only seen, and he won't listen to this bit of the podcast, it's fine. Notoriously, I have only seen the ones around his write-up because I was trying to make myself feel better. So I just watched the Coke Tower appear.
So seared into my brain, there's a thumbnail where he's just like basically biting his laptop in exasperation.
Yeah. That is, if you could just summarize the PhD write-up in one photo for most people, I think it would be that. But yeah, before that, I mean, it already sounds like you're doing all right with, you said you do stick to quite set work hours and make sure you do a lot outside of it.
Yeah, for the most part. I try to stick to fairly standard working hours, mostly just because routine helps me a lot. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that it's the easiest thing in the world to like keep that balance. And I think I have realized relatively recently that I perhaps made a bit of a mistake when I started the PhD. Mm-hmm. Which is that I didn't really, like, as much as I was balancing work and not work, the not work stuff was primarily stuff that was either very tied to the department, mm-hmm. so stuff like Friday pub and that sort of thing, or mostly stuff that I was doing at home that I've been doing for years, like playing video games, making YouTube videos, all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that I'm realizing now that I probably have not done enough of the actually have, like, develop a life in Cardiff.
Yeah, so sort of get like setting
as opposed
up a base.
To my portable life that I can move everywhere.
Pandemic is something that strongly affected all of us, but you are allowed to go outside and settle and touch grass and all that stuff, Thomas.
I mean, if I go outside, it's very warm. It's been very warm down here at the minute. I've been having to avoid sunburn quite a lot.
So you say avoid sunscreen. I'm like, that's quite a bold approach.
Well, I avoid sunscreen by staying inside.
No, but you do raise a good point. British complaints about the weather aside, of making sure that you do have a bigger community than just the academic department you're in. And I think this goes for sort of any workplace. I think, especially in the modern era, there's this whole concept of like us not having a third space to go to like you have work, you have home, and then somewhere else, and most of those somewhere else's are places you have to pay to be. So whether that's sort of a pub or a cafe, yeah, or a society or a sporting event or something, like, typically there's some sort of monetary stuff attached. Local libraries are fantastic, putting that one out there.
Yeah, I was thinking that the libraries are like the only thing that I can really think of beyond like public parks,
yeah,
that are like free to just exist.
Yes. But typically finding a community and then figuring out where that sits is also quite good. So for me, there was like a yoga studio in Bath that didn't have anyone from the department that went to it. And it meant that mm-hmm. there was an entirely new group of people that just worked and lived in Bath. And maybe some of them were students, maybe some of them were at the university, but it was no one I knew through my PhD. So it was an entirely mm-hmm. separate to maths group of people. And like, it was an activity that I enjoyed, and it was really community focused. Like, we had event days on top of, and there was a WhatsApp group, and there was just a separate space to work. And I think the best advice I had from someone was like, get friends that aren't maths. Like, I love that you have your maths friends, but like, go hang out with people that aren't maths so that you can't talk work. You can't talk shop. Because as you said, one of your social events is like department drinks. And that's great for team building, but then you are talking shop. Like, you might think you're not, but even casually, a lot of what you talk about is talking shop, I would imagine. Unless y'all actually figured out how not to do that.
Yeah, but even if it's not like specifically talking about what work you're doing, there's all the sort of informal chats about like about the stuff around the work that all encompasses the PhD.
You can say that you're gossiping about other academics, Thomas. It's okay, we all do it.
That's not really what I mean.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, I know that's what you mean. Yeah, interestingly, the one thing that I have found is like actually stops us all talking shop. There's quite a few folk in the department that like playing board games.
Mm.
But like really complicated ones where you can't talk about other things because you've got to focus on what you're doing next.
Oh, amazing. Yeah, big distraction is definitely a good shout. But again, it's having that like extra activity, I think, can make a world of difference. And also just shared interests with people. Can really help build a community vibe, having that core thing to bond over. Name drop the game, Thomas, just because I'm curious.
Oh, which ones have we been playing? We played Scythe recently.
Ooh.
And Concordia.
Haven't heard of Concordia.
Played Dune Imperium as well, which is very complicated. You don't need to know anything about Dune, but because I don't.
What?
Concordia is good. Concordia is kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of like halfway between, I don't know, it's been likened to sort of Risk but Roman Empire,
mm-hmm.
but it's not quite Risk either, it's strange.
Its own thing, very cool. I think I've finally found people that will play Betrayal and House of the Hill, or whatever the small words in that sentence are, with me. Betrayal at House on the Hill is the correct words. It's so good.
Okay.
There's murder mystery, spooky, scary skeletons.
I still need to get folks together and like play Catan, because I have it, but I've never played it.
Oh my god. Most of my undergrad was playing Catan. It was very good. I kept trying to go for Longest Road. I didn't really care about winning. I just wanted Longest Road. And as soon as people know that about me, it kind of defeats me being there. But I had a great time. So there's that. We completely segued, I'm going to be honest.
We really did.
Try to think about how to get back on topic, and I'm like, but like, board games though. I mean, one thing to be said that I think, not to be like, no, don't ever make friends, don't ever build a life, but like, PhDs are a finite amount of time, and if you do want to stay in academia, there's no guarantee you can stay where you are. And leaving the place that you start to call home after it finishes is quite sad. I wish I could be like, and I figured out how to fix it, but I haven't. I am now...
No, I don't think anyone ever does.
Yeah. I'm now 9-10 months out of leaving Bath, I think. And I now feel more at home where I am. But I do still... I now have, like, 3 different places that I get all... just like a little bit of homesickness for. I have like where my family are, I have my undergrad location, and I have my PhD location now, and it's nice because I go back and I get the same like sentimentality when I visit Bath as I do with Cardiff, or to some extent. Cardiff definitely has more of my heartstrings just because it's also in Wales, but It's like, I miss it, but it's still England, you know, so yeah. But yeah, it's nice to build homes sort of dotted everywhere, but it is also a bit bittersweet, I suppose.
No, I totally get that. And yeah, I don't think anyone's ever going to find a solution to that one. But like, at the same time, it's not a reason to just like make yourself miserable for 4 years because you don't want to get attached.
No, because 4 years is a really long time. And like, it's,
yeah.
Like, I think, I mean, to be honest, if people are having commitment issues with cities, that is outside of the scope that we are qualified to talk about.
Yeah, true.
That's not
I
for
mean,
us.
This implies we're qualified to talk about anything, but...
This is true. We are not qualified. Don't listen to anything we say as gospel. Except maybe board games. Our jury's out.
I was going to say, you're qualified on, like, bouncing droplets, but, like...
This is true. But, okay, so what are your plans to, like, get more Cardiff-y? I can recommend some chippies.
Are they all in Chippy Lane?
Yeah. Okay, but seriously, what are your plans to immerse yourself more in the Welsh culture?
Eh? I haven't thought that far.
Okay. Better question. How are you going to make time? Because it sounds like you're already pretty busy.
Sleep's optional, right?
Thomas.
I'm kidding. I don't know. I haven't thought that through yet either.
Mm. It's a hard one. There's like this, especially when you want to be in a sort of like yes mode of like, I want to do new things and we should do the experiences and like we should take advantage of the fact that like, have you been to Castle Coch yet?
Not in, but I've been up to it.
Okay, good. But like...
I cycled up there a few weeks ago.
Ah, you cycled up there?
I've cycled up to Merthyr Tydfil before.
Why?
Because I got as far as Pontypridd and then I was like, I might as well keep going.
To Merthyr?
I got the train back. It was way too far.
That's fair. It was more the Merthyr that I was complaining about than the distance. What was I saying? Yeah, but then you already have a full plate, so it's making sure that you can appropriately allocate something that I am now learning how to do. So as I said, I went to the gym. I'm just like flexing on anything. I got my PB on my squat for the first time in like 4 or 5 years after getting injured, and I'm very excited about it. But going to the gym, I'm currently doing a program and a friend was like, oh, you should come do this other sport with me. And I'm like, yes, I would love to do that. But I'm going to wait until the program that I'm on at the gym currently finishes so that I can then reduce the amount of time I'm spending at the gym and then start doing this new sport. And it's sort of that like for like almost switch of like, I'm still getting the same amount of exercise. So that's good for me. And I'm happy. And my brain goes brr in the right way for if I don't run around, I get, you know, sad. But I'm not taking on too much. So trying to like, if you're not distributing your time between like work, relationships, family, sleep, self-care, like that bit first, sort that out. But if you are, it's maybe swapping one for one. Like if you want to go to do a new research project, maybe you wait until a previous research project finishes. Maybe, you know, having a few things on the back burner in the future.
I think that sort of thing of like trying to figure out how to like balance that can be really tricky to get right. But I've certainly found like I've been getting there with the work side of things. So one of the things that I do during term time or have done during term time up to this point is like officially it's lab demonstrating, but it's computer labs, so it's helping undergrads figure out how Python works. During term time, that takes up like a decent amount of my time. But then as soon as undergrads, you know, stop having classes because they have to do exams. God, I don't miss that. Like, because they have to do exams, the classes stop, and I'm like, ah, cool, I can now make loads of progress with all that stuff. And in reality, that means it frees up my head to do other things because I'm not stressed about, I should have got through all of these things in this week, and I haven't. I've also, like, been trying to do the exercise thing to, like, because, yeah, it helps your head.
Something that I think I probably text one of my best friends too much is I hate when I'm just a houseplant. And I think I saw it on an Instagram once, and it was like a meme that was like, we are nothing more than slightly more loud houseplants, because if we get enough water, enough sunlight, and enough food, we're probably fine. And I'll be having a bad day, and I'll be having a grump, and I'll go and do some exercise, or I'll go and have some water, I'll sleep properly, and it does normally fit. Like, again, if there's something underlying that's a bit more serious that those things don't help, we are not the right place to be giving the advice for that. But
go speak to a professional.
Yes. Sort of first, you know, triage-y checkpoint is, are you hitting your basic needs? If yes, and it fixes it. Fantastic. But yeah, I am normally a houseplant. I am normally dehydrated. Like 80% of my bad mood is hunger or dehydration. Maybe I should have gone to Keto Tools. Maybe that would fix my problem.
I mean, it caused other problems. Instant access to far too much potato.
Actually, on a completely different topic, just to segue again to make Thomas's life a nightmare for editing, what you were saying about make sure that you tick everything off. I was going to say earlier, if people are less like you in the having the structured 9-to-5 and more like me with the I work when my brain is good, something that I found that really, really does help me is instead of seeing things as like amounts of time, see them as tasks. And like,
yes,
task lists can be overwhelming, especially if you just write like do PhD. That's too big of a thing to get done.
That is too big of a thing.
But what is sort of more quantifiable and something I'm obsessed with, or I used to do bullet journaling, and I still do something similar where like I'll have like a year-long goal list, which maybe that would be like finish PhD or whatever big career tasks you want to get done. And then I'll have like a monthly one for slightly more broken down things. So I think on my monthly checklist, it's things like prep a talk that needs to be done in a few months' time. And like, you know, the things that will get done eventually. And then, you know, on the weekly or the daily, the more immediate, it's okay, what physically can I get done today? And that was like edit a video, reply to all the emails I need to reply to, really start breaking things down a lot more. And that suddenly becomes less like, okay, I need to do 9-to-5 and that's really stressful. It's like I can break it into smaller, and if that stuff gets done, you know, 7 p.m. because I'm listening to my favorite podcast, which is the Unstable Fluid podcast, by the way.
Of course.
Yeah, of course. And like I'm in the right headspace for it and I get it done, then fantastic. And if I don't, I know I have deadlines, so I can work to that. And I found that helped me at the very least.
I do a similar sort of thing, but with the added structure of I will have like my bigger overarching goals than like the monthly goals and then the what I want to get done this week things. And I did think I did go through a point where I did try and like rank them into this is a small brain task, this is a big brain task.
Small brain and big brain.
Yeah, I think I did go through a sort of thing where I did like try and rank them in my like rank them before, but I now just do it sort of implicitly. Where like I will have the structure of like I'm gonna work from 9 till 5 on a Monday, and sometimes the motivation is there, the dopamine has been found somehow, and I can handle the difficult paper comments or the this code doesn't work and I don't know why, let's figure it out sort of things. The other times when the brain is not braining,
yeah,
it's more the right, I'm going to go and scroll through like a week's worth of archive emails and put in the hours for demonstrating that I should have done 3 weeks ago and forgot about.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
Yeah. I think that's a really good way to split it up though, of like, here's the big things and then here's the small ones. Because like the amount of energy and like mental preparation that goes into each of those different tasks is quite different. And research is quite a hard one to quantify sometimes, because, you know, I could describe my job as I sit in a corner and think about numbers, and then how intense that is might vary.
Can we make that the tagline on your website? Just, I sit in a corner and think about numbers.
Yeah, why not? Like, my bloody profile picture's me in an England jersey. At this point, my entire social media platforms are community driven. As much as I can describe my job, sitting in a corner and thinking about maths, some things are more intensive than others, and being able to sort of either preemptively or retroactively scale how much energy you have in a given day. So like I, going into a 12-hour exam, knew that the day after I did not want to do anything super intensive, so intentionally scheduled a load of really small light tasks for the next day, and that meant that I sort of like balanced myself out a bit more. So I unfortunately I did have one commitment where I had to do a speaking thing that day, but the day after that I did no in-person talking. I tried to have no meetings, so I didn't have to talk to anyone, and I could really like minimize how much human interaction I needed, because I knew that that would be the thing that would help me recharge and get my work done. So I shifted a lot of stuff, and I
and that's the thing that over time you'll like everyone sort of learns about themselves, is what things are more draining to them than others.
Yeah, for some people, you know, talking and presenting is like energizing almost. And for some people, it's the, you know, sitting and coding is fun. I haven't met anyone that thinks that yet, but like, I believe they exist. Really? Really?
Hi.
Don't wave at me, Thomas. Absolute liar.
I like coding.
Yeah. I like coding. I just don't think it's fun. I find it satisfying.
I think it's fun.
It's like type 2 type fun.
What?
Have you not heard of this?
No.
So there's a thing, I can't remember where it came from, but like it calls it 3 different types of fun. So type 1 fun is enjoyable while it's happening. So like just wholesome good old fun, like playing a game or something really. I mean, the example that is on the website that I just clicked and found had like sport climbing and margaritas. A type 1 fun. Type 2 fun is miserable while it's happening, but fun in retrospect. So that's stuff like going to the gym or doing something really intensive, but like really rewarding. Like doing a 12-hour maths exam. It's type 2 fun. It's not fun during, but it's fun after, and you would probably do it again. Type 3 fun is not fun.
Okay.
Oh, type 3 fun is not fun, but makes a good story. So like you would tell people about it.
So a PhD?
Yeah, yeah. Type 3 fun is trauma, I think, is what the internet has just told me from a quick Google. People, hit up the socials and let us know what type 3 fun is, if there's any good one.
Are we just saying type 3 fun is just comedy? It's like tragedy plus time.
Yes. Yes. That.
Okay.
That. Most PhD work is type 2 fun, or type 3 fun, of like, I don't think it's enjoyable during. But regardless, the things that you need to do to balance yourself out in a week. So if you have something that's very intensive, hopefully you then balance that with being calmer throughout the week. And it's a theory that I actually picked up from a friend of mine who has ME called Spoon Theory. Have you heard of Spoon Theory, Thomas?
I have heard of Spoon Theory, though I may have heard of Spoon Theory from you, so I'm not sure.
So it's something that is like, created for the sort of chronic illness community of people who generally don't have necessarily as much energy and can't do as much as someone else, for example. So it was came up with to try and describe like how much energy someone has in a day. So like a typical person without any sort of hidden illness going on might be able to just kind of not even think about how much energy sending emails or making phone calls or having a shower or looking after themselves might take, whereas someone who sort of has a finite resource.
Yeah, those sorts of things would be the sorts of things that most people would just be like, ah, that is just part of daily life. I just get on with it. I don't need to think about it.
Yeah, like maybe they would, like someone would think about the, you know, energy it would take to run an ultra marathon, but they might not think about the smaller things. Whereas someone with a sort of hidden disability, they have to sort of really carefully ration their energy. The person that came up with it, Christine Miserandino, she was explaining to a friend, I think over dinner, her whole like story is on her website about where it came from, but it was back in like 2003. But it was basically that she was sat at a table and she was trying to explain to a friend like dealing with this energy loss, and she just gave her friend a bunch of spoons and was like, tell me about your day. And the friend was like, right, well, I got up and I had breakfast. And then she like took 2 spoons off her. So she had like fewer spoons left. And it's like, okay, that's why have you taken 2 off me? And it's like, well, getting up takes an amount of energy to start with. And then what did I say? Brushing your teeth or having breakfast. Like that takes something else. And not only are you, okay, well, now I only have like 5 spoons left and I've got so much left to do today. So the rationing mentality, and seeing like small tasks or tasks that you wouldn't necessarily think of as these like finite resources. And it's unique for each person. So maybe something, you know, self-care related might be really difficult for some people, or like if someone has anxiety, they can really struggle with like, I find phone calls very stressful.
To the choir.
Yeah, I know. But like I would much rather do so many other tasks than actually try and make a phone call or book an appointment. Or
there is only one thing that can like drive me to want to actively make a phone call.
Uh-huh.
An absolutely terrible customer service web chat. That is the only thing.
No, the only way I think the trick that I found for me is I have to do it on behalf of someone else.
Ah, the mum friend override.
Yes, yes. Mum friend override is exactly right, Thomas. It's not, I'm not doing it for me. I'm doing it for the people around me that have to deal with me if I don't do this thing. Is the backwards logic we have to get to. But yeah, so spoon theory and I think spoonies is the collective term of group of people that subscribe to this theory, is a fantastic way of just kind of visualizing the energy level specifically, but the rationing of us as a resource. Like, you are a finite amount of human. I don't think we have any infinite entities listening to us. If we do, hi, welcome. You are more than happy to be here. But typically, most of our listeners are going to be people, I would assume.
One would assume.
One, yeah.
Probably a few cats just around the place.
Yeah. As there should be. But yeah, so kind of thinking about it of like, if there is something that is really re-energizing to you, doing that so that it balances out something that might be really energy draining. And I think it's something that PhD students could really benefit from thinking about and like doing a bit of introspection, which is scary. yeah.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that people certainly can benefit from. And like, I think it's probably important. I think it's important to understand where the idea of it came from.
Mm.
But it is one of those things that can be more generally applicable to, like, particularly mental resources when it comes to trying to do research and understand that, yeah, different, like, as much as we can write down a list of tasks, not all tasks are equal. Mm. Like, some tasks are really easy, like send some emails, or might be really easy, like send some emails. Whereas, like, trying to understand something really complex from a paper could be really, really difficult for one person or really easy compared to sending emails for somebody else.
Yeah. And I think appreciating the fact that if we had the same tasks in a given week, heaven forbid you become a mathematician, and we suddenly have to do exactly the same things, our priorities are going to be slightly different. So,
yeah.
Although we agree on phone calls are the devil, the additional thing might be that I really prefer putting all my thoughts down in email, whereas you would prefer having a face-to-face conversation. So maybe when we're working with collaborators or our supervisors, how we would approach, I need to tell them that I'm stuck, might be quite different to balance our own needs. So the thing that I think of is I really don't like being wrong. I feel very perceived, funnily enough. Don't know if this comes across in everything. But my supervisor would know that I would hide rather than tell him there's something wrong. So we would have regularly scheduled meetings that we would stick to in order to really make sure that even if it was just a check-in, I had that space face-to-face so I didn't have to email him going, I'm having a problem. Which, yeah, if it took about 2 years for us to figure out that that's what was happening with me. So again, the sooner the better you do that introspection of what works for me, the better.
I think that's something that's really important to figure out because, yeah, I find it... I never send my supervisor an email, ever.
Really?
If it's something really quick, then I'll... Like, we have a like department Slack, so I'll drop like a quick message there. Mm-hmm. There are very few things that I'm just like, this is urgent enough that I need to speak to my supervisor now and small enough that it can be done like as a Slack message. Like you said, I find it easier to have a face-to-face meeting and discuss those things with like an agenda. I have a weekly meeting on a Friday with my supervisor because it's the time that worked best. I have a standing thing in my, because I use Todoist as a to-do app, and I have like a recurring thing on a Thursday, which is prepare for my supervisor meeting. And it's like, go through and be like, I want to talk about this for this project, this for this other project, this for this other project. And I'm going to, or decide which thing is the most important. We'll talk about that first, because sometimes conversations expand to fill the available time and other things get pushed. But I basically go into my meetings with like an agenda, because otherwise, as much as I like having a face-to-face meeting and find that really productive, if it's basically free form, that is is far more taxing than something that, like, where I'm going in with, like, a set list of objectives of I want to talk about these things.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. I find it so interesting seeing how different people navigate their own work relationships. And I think, honestly, the sign of a fantastic supervisor is if someone was able to supervise both of us with our own respective supervision styles. Like, different academics will have their own preference of how they want to supervise a PhD student, but being able to adapt to what the PhD student needs in that time. I think my PhD supervisory meetings were always like 5-10 minutes of like, how's it going? Are you okay? And like, idle gossip first, and then, okay, what's the one thing we're going to address in this meeting? And then if there were lots of things, it would be multiple shorter meetings spread out, because like, both of our attention spans were like, right, this one thing, let's do this one thing, let's focus on one thing. But if we didn't have the like chit chat at the start, I'd get really stressed.
I have like basically an hour of my supervisor's time that is set aside for me on a Friday. And as much as like, it means that yes, I have to focus and actually be mentally present for that hour, it means I know that it is that hour.
Yes.
And if it needs, if I need to have more time, then I will either schedule another meeting that I can prepare for, or reschedule my meeting to a time where it can be longer.
Yeah, I suppose the caveat there is, I, again, coming from supervisor that was head of department, then on sabbatical, then in COVID, and then in America, and then I was working, and then like, there were a lot of factors in my PhD that meant like 15, 30 minutes here and there was the best that either of us could do.
Oh, I sympathize. I had my master's supervisor was our head of department, and there were times that I like had a scheduled meeting and would rock up, and his PA would just be like, "He's off hiking in the Highlands. Did he not tell you?"
Amazing. I mean, at least your head of department had a PA.
Okay, when I say I had a scheduled meeting with the head of department, I mean I'd emailed his PA and said, "Can I have a meeting with him?"
Yeah, my supervisor for my undergrad was also head of department. I think I have an academic type, but they had a PA and they were fantastic, and they scheduled a lot of our meetings and it was great. And then I came to Bath and my supervisor was head of department there, and I didn't realize when I was picking, but yeah, just the head of department. So I would email my supervisor, "Hey, where are you? I'm outside your office," and I'd get back, "Oh, I'm in France. Thanks, buddy."
Great.
I mean, they then called and we had an online meeting and they were fantastic. I by no means wish to disparage my PhD supervisor. I adore them completely. But it is not only about figuring out what works for you, it's kind of preemptively figuring out if you're in the pre-supervisor stage of this work, or if you're about to start working with someone in a collaborator style or whatever, it's figuring out how they are going to be and then managing your expectations on each other.
I think managing those expectations can be like a really key aspect of getting that sort of supervisor-supervisee relationship right, because I mean, I'm sure we've said this before on the podcast, but your supervisor relationship is suboptimal, then your PhD will be very suboptimal. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things, like, I kind of knew that going in because I've spoken to people who have been doing PhDs.
I've been screaming it at you.
So yeah, before starting the PhD, I was talking to people doing PhDs like yourself, like Simon, who've like really hammered home, like, you need to get that supervisor-student relationship right from the get-go. So like, I think basically my first meeting with my supervisor after like starting, I was like, right, I'm going to need to have weekly meetings because otherwise I will not schedule them myself. Mm-hmm. And ideally, if they are at like a consistent time most weeks, because if they're not, I will get stressed.
Yeah.
My supervisor's like, yeah, that's awesome. From like the word go, I'm like, I have lucked out here.
Yeah. I think the fact that you went in knowing what you wanted from it as well was probably really helpful for them, so they didn't have to spend that time figuring that out with you. But yeah, like, I will continually scream at anyone I meet that it doesn't necessarily matter what the project is outside of a given field. It matters entirely what the work environment is like, and that is your supervisor relationship. And then it's all the other stuff, like your community life, like your department, like what resources you have, like what funding your university has, all of that stuff. Most people, I would say, come secondary.
Everything else could be perfect, but if the relationship with the supervisor is hell, then the PhD will be off.
I think as well, like, knowing what their expectations for you and the project is also good. Like, I say the project doesn't matter in its entirety, but knowing sort of what expectation to have, what expectations you both have, whether that's like, okay, here is the one question and we're just gonna like let you loose and see where you go with it. My PhD was sort of like, okay, we're going to build this model, and how complicated this model gets will depend on what happens over the next few years. I was on the Behind the Research episode. Shout out to the other thing I used to do back in the day. One of our guests was saying whenever they have a new PhD student, they sort of picture what the thesis would look like at the end and work backwards from that. So within a given field, they would say, okay, so maybe like 5 chapters, you know, your classic introduction, conclusion, top and tailing it. Maybe like 3 projects sort of make sense in this, 3 distinct sort of things. And that would be the split. And then, okay, by year 2, we sort of want to be wrapping that up. By year 3, we want to be wrapping that up. They would sort of loosely plan. And obviously that changes, but they would, for most of their students, they had going in this like nice idea of, or an idea of what the end goal looked like. So they knew what on time meant. And if you're the sort of person that likes sort of knowing where you're going, you like the destination, knowing the destination, that's quite a nice way to look at it, I thought.
Quite like that. I don't know exactly how my supervisor went about trying to do that, but like, as much as like I have my project title, which is simulating CGM massive galaxies, like I came in, like my supervisor had like this sort of an idea of the initial first project. Now that project did not happen to be my first one because of various reasons. It's now project number 2, which is what I'm starting now. But like, yeah, that sort of thing of having, I guess, like understanding those expectations, because my supervisor came into it as like, here is the first project I think you should have a look at. So I started exploring that and discovered there were issues that we needed other people to resolve things before we could do it.
Yeah.
But I had that sort of freedom to also explore and figure out what I actually want to do as the first project. Whereas other supervisors will come in with like an idea of, this is what you're going to do first, this is what you're going to do after that, sort of thing. And I guess you kind of have to figure out like that sort of balance of how much direction the student is expecting versus how much direction the supervisor is expecting to give.
Or, so you've hit on a classic PhD student pub topic of who's in charge of a project. And the answer is, it's non-trivial, and you should like listen to the supervisor, because they in theory should know, but also it's your career, so you do have quite a lot of freedom. It is a partnership, it is both of you.
They are your supervisor, they are not your boss.
Yes, yeah. But it is an interesting one of if you know that you need to get to, say your research topic is in 2 phases, you know you need to get to the end of phase 1 to start phase 2. And if you don't get there, that's half a project disappearing. Or if you're doing 2 completely different things and they tie together under some theme, then you do have a lot more freedom. I always think of it as like a branching, I'm going to say a branching process, and people in maths are going to think that means a branching process, and I'm going to adamantly say no, I'm not a probabilist. But like a branching process, right? Like if you tail off in one direction, maybe it joins back to the overall thread, maybe it doesn't, maybe that's okay, maybe it's not. But generally speaking, having some awareness of sort of where you're going, like I had no idea what my thesis was going to look like by the end, when I was about halfway through. And I think that's okay.
So I was going to say, if you had no idea what it was going to look like by the end, at the end, there was something wrong, but...
Yeah, okay. I mean, halfway through writing, I think I'd sort of figured... No, I think it was about 6 months before I was going to start finishing up. So maybe 3 months before I wanted to write up, I kind of sat down with my supervisor and was like, right, there's enough... I've done enough work now. I know once we finish the thing we're finishing, we've got enough work there. Let's figure out what the structure is going to be. Whereas I know there are academics that prefer it the other way around, and figuring out which one works for you is good, as well, especially if you are dependent. So you said that your first research project didn't go ahead because of other things that needed to finish off first.
Yeah, there was some issues with the simulations that I was supposed to be using for that relied on us testing a specific physical process, and we discovered that the implementation of that physical process had errors in it that were bad enough they needed to be fixed before we could go any further with that project.
Yeah, so I think it's something that happens quite a lot. I suppose my job is I added in on lots of different research projects. I don't have my own research stream to follow through, but it means that I am seeing a lot of times where I'm working on something that is sort of a block in a chain of like, okay, mm-hmm. so work package one gets done and then, you know, the mathematicians come in and that's where we do a thing and then that gets sent off to computer science or psychology or to government or industry or whatever. And like, there's a series of people that's work is all dependent on each other. Or maybe it's concurrent, maybe it's one after the other. But realizing that that can also happen during your PhD. Realizing that I'm seeing it now as an academic, but like when I was a PhD student, I couldn't start the more complicated version of my model until I'd made the model in the first place. So mm-hmm. having an awareness of, for yourself, what the project in its entirety, like the big picture stuff, so that you know where is appropriate to sort of cut things off or tie things up or go back in or add something new. It can be really important. And it can also help with, as I was saying before, going back to the to-do lists of like, okay, this is like a week task, not a month task or not a year task. Like it makes things look a bit more manageable and means that if you do need to pause for whatever reason, you can do that.
There's definitely a lot to be said for just sort of that understanding of what relies on what needs to be done where and that sort of thing. And I think I'm kind of encountering that sort of thing at the moment because as of time of recording, I'm 3 months Ooh. Away from needing to sort of tie up everything for an industry placement that I am required to do as part of my PhD because of like requirements from the funding body. So from September, I will be not doing my PhD for 6 months. I will be going and doing a different project with a thing in Bristol, which will be nothing to do with my PhD.
Mm-hmm.
But right now I've got this paper that's nearly ready to submit. I've got the stuff for the second project that was supposed to be the first project, but it's now the second that I need to like get off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's simulations that need run and I don't know if they'll get run before I go on the placement, but they're the sort of thing that I can run, that can run while I'm away and that sort of mm-hmm. thing. So there's that aspect of getting that all sorted out. And then I have my side quest, the PhD side quest, not all the other side quests, which is a paper for this collaboration that I'll talk about later, different episode. But it's another thing that I need to be aware of and get to a point that it can be sort of left, my part of it can be left for 6 months while other people do their parts of the project.
And I suppose if you didn't have that big picture attitude and you were just looking at day to day to day to day, suddenly 3 months would go by in a flash and you'd have to just pause everything and not necessarily have things wrapped up neat and tidily.
What would be your main thing, like main bit of advice to people who are like trying to get the whole PhD balance with the rest of life and not ending up as a puddle of stress by about, you know, a year and a half in?
First point of order is check houseplant behaviours of food, water, shelter, sleep. Second point of order is check pet-like behavior. No, this is getting weird. I was like, but then it's like, okay, so it's like the hierarchy of needs or whatever it's called, right? It's like, are you eating enough? Are you sleeping enough? Are you drinking enough? And then it's, are you getting enough exercise? Are you getting enough sunlight? Are you going and doing things that you enjoy? And then it's like, okay, if there's a more stress going on there, is your work relationships, like, are you having a good balance with your supervisor? Do you need to adjust anything? There's nothing wrong with halfway through your PhD turning around to your super, it can be scary, but you can do it, turning around to your supervisor and going, actually, can we do things differently? Academics can be set in their ways and that can be really intimidating, but it's better to do it halfway through than right at the end. One of the things that I think we haven't touched on, but we definitely should, is like there are resources out there and communities or things like this podcast and like other things of PhD or ex-PhD students kind of screaming into the void of don't make the mistakes I did. And one of those is a really good book called Managing Your Mental Health During Your PhD by Zoe. It is fantastic. Highly recommend reading it.
I absolutely back this. I have not read the full thing, but I have read a decent chunk of it and I back that book. It is really good. And like a lot of university libraries have it or have access to the ebook version of it. So like, I back it.
Because I think a lot of the time, realizing that you're not alone in the scary thoughts of, oh god, how do I make this all balance, can help. Like, it sometimes it's just reassuring to, like, okay, I don't understand how this works, but neither does anyone else. And that's okay, maybe.
Yeah. I think for me, the thing for me is, like, very much trying to get that balance. And, like, I've got that sort of, I don't know, I kind of got into that sort of routine of being very comfortable with, I go to work, I come home, I do things at home, and I need to, I think I'm realizing that I need to try and get out of my comfort zone is the wrong way to describe it. Like, it's, I don't like, anything that sounds like a cliche, it's just like, it doesn't fully capture what I'm trying to say. But, like, yeah, I don't know. I think that sort of trying to look at the bigger picture and doing that sort of swapping things in and out, I think is perhaps useful.
Yeah, like maybe not a shift of time allocation, but just what those things are sometimes.
Yeah, can be good.
And going out and touching the Welsh grass is also, I've heard, great for you.
Yeah, I'll make wait till it stops raining. But yeah, I think maybe we should finish this on a lighter note. What are you looking forward to, like, soon?
It is conference season. I am about to have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I mean, we talk about work-life balance. I'm about to have 7 weeks back-to-back of events.
Oh, to have a travel budget.
But I have made sure that it is at most one thing a week, and that will be, like, you know, an afternoon counts as my one big thing in the week. I have shifted all of my, like, big work, like, heavy thinky research has been sort of paused, so I don't have anything to do that. So I just have lots of talky things, and I'm going to make sure that I have lots of quiet time in between my big talky events. But yeah, it is conference season, and it's my favorite time of the year because I just adore conferences. We talked about it last time. The designated extrovert, but, like, secretly introvert. So big energy there, and then go cry in a corner somewhere afterwards. It's going to be great. What about you? What's the looking forward?
On Saturday, I'm disappearing off to the islands for, like, 2 weeks. Got a week in Inverness, got a week on Skye. It's gonna be great. And then, yeah, we're sort of getting into conference season. Heading up to Durham for a week, co-leading a session and giving a talk, so it'll be good.
Awesome.
And those are the same. My talk is in my session, and my session is on day one, so I get to enjoy the rest of the week without the stress. It's gonna be great.
Best feeling ever.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unstable Fluid Podcast with Thomas Rintoul and Kat Phillips. If you enjoyed the episode, please share it with a friend and maybe send us a message on Instagram @UnstableFluidPodcast to let us know what you enjoyed.